Project Startup. Introduction. Yet another new project. Soon it'll be time to pick out a nice color for your Porsche. Or Tesla. Or whatever. You get the idea. In this final unit, we're going to combine the skills we've acquired along the way with a review of an entire project's professional workflow. How do professional web developers approach a new project? Along with planning and working with marketing, they set up their code for source control, which is a key part of professional workflow. Professional web projects also regularly work with file uploads, databases, and various different kinds of storage as well. This is where you're going to start to become acquainted with the routine tasks of daily professional web development. Your reputation is starting to grow beyond the music scene. Someone has referred a photographer, Antoine Christensen, who owns a small gallery in downtown Montreal. This person is great with a camera, but needs some help with his site. The software development lifecycle. We've taken a look at project management before, but as always, the professional take on project management is a little more complicated in order to accommodate many different kinds of requirements, levels of complexity and engineering, and client needs. You'll hear a lot of different kinds of names for this: waterfall, iterative, agile, and so on. They're all a part of SDLC. SDLC stands for Software Development Lifecycle. SDLC manages development costs and complexity by applying a cyclical series of steps to the development process. There are different ways or models that are used, but they all account for a series of steps that look a little bit like this. Planning and analysis. Planning and analysis are fundamental to any web project. No matter how straightforward a project might seem, the first order of business is to make sure you understand the problem in front of you. This means understanding the range of possible users and their own conceptions of the problem, the nature of the datasets involved, any hidden assumptions with which a client might be so familiar that they forget to mention them, the technology required, and so on. Design. Before any coding begins, it's best to sit down and complete a sitemap and wireframes. Understanding screen layouts, user workflows, and required visual elements helps translate the site's requirements into a series of identifiable tasks. Each task or module can be thought of as a unit of work or a milestone that needs to be checked off toward the project's completion. Implementation. Here, it's time to write code and create the site's assets. While this step is what it seems, creating code and actually constructing the site, the coding happens in a context of directed tasks. The point is to create units of functionality that have been clearly defined during the design phase in order to reach some predetermined stage of completion. This way, you're not just creating a code base that grows and gets out of control. You're coding towards a milestone that represents a real accomplishment. Testing. Testing is a big topic. There are many different types of testing. Some testing is often done during the implementation phase of a project in order to ensure that code is developed correctly. More testing occurs as a project is deployed to simulate real-world usage loads and to find possible issues with hosting or other parts of the technology chain. In fact, for many websites, testing is an ongoing concern. Because testing requires setup and its own set of concerns, it's thought of as a separate phase. Developers will often jump back and forth between coding and testing. Deployment and maintenance. When the site reaches a suitable milestone, it's deployed, but the story isn't over. Deployed websites are always changing. As a working website ages, new technologies emerge, security vulnerabilities need to be repaired, new requirements pop up, and refinements need to be put into place. Because of new requirements, the site will enter into a new cycle of development, and the process starts all over again. From theory to practice. The client interview. Planning begins with talking to the client. Sometimes they know exactly what they need, there are knowledgeable clients out there, and sometimes they're not as informed. The goal of the client interview is to define the project, smoke out any possible misunderstandings or hidden assumptions, and try to get everyone quite literally on the same page, with a document that explicitly lists and specifies project requirements. Back to our new project. Like you learned earlier in the course, you begin with planning and requirements gathering, So the first step is to meet with the client and conduct an interview. In a real-world context, this could take a while. Getting to know clients is a process, and not all clients are crystal clear on what they want or need. That said, notes from an introductory interview, which would include questions about purpose, technical requirements, design preferences, and scheduling, might look something like this. The site should showcase Christensen's past work. The site will be installed in a kiosk, a small standalone pedestal with a display, and used as part of a gallery show that will run for a month and commences in less than a week. Essentially, the site is a basic homepage with a link to a list of images, each with its own description. The client will need to upload images and provide the accompanying text. This is something that he wants to do himself. The project will initially be a homepage, the image showcase, and a guest book page where users can express interest in the client's work and join a mailing list. While it would be possible to put the contact form on the homepage, the client wants the homepage to be very clean, a nice image, and some minimal text. This isn't a public site, so there's no need for authentication. The client needs the site to be deployed ASAP. Every measure should be taken to ensure fast, reliable completion. Okay, so we're starting off small, which should make things easier, but the deadline is an issue. We won't be using any new technology or implementing any slick features. We'll keep it simple and try to satisfy the client with good work and a quick turnaround. Competitive analysis. If this site were a public-facing product, it would be useful to do a competitive analysis. There are many ways to perform an evaluation of the competition, but even evaluations for much larger sites might still begin with a simple search of known competitors. Taking screenshots and making notes about how content is being presented, essentially constructing content map sketches, would be key. Paramount among all concerns is how competitors are viewing, addressing, and making appeals to their clients. Once some preliminary information has been gathered, a typical next step is to use a web analytics tool like Amazon's Alexa or an SEO tool like Moz. Yes, Alexa is the product that Amazon wants you to install in your home, but Alexa is also a tool for evaluating a site's popularity, competition, and other metrics. Examining lists of sites that you put together is a great first step, but tools like these can help you zero in on your competitors' popularity rankings and the SEO techniques that will help you gain a competitive edge. Our project is part of a show, and it's not necessary in this case to compete with public-facing sites. That said, it might be worthwhile to do an hour's worth of research in order to collect some examples of similar sites done by others. It's never a mistake to gather good ideas. Design. We've done our first round of gathering requirements, and we know what the client wants. The site is very simple, but it's a good idea to generate some wireframes so that we know exactly what we're building. This will help us to avoid overlooking anything later in the process. Remember, too, that even though you're a one-developer shop, and this is a small site, process is still important. This version of the process, which is somewhat simplified, makes things easier to understand. As projects grow larger and more complex, however, the process becomes much more critical, and therefore even more precise and rigorous. The content for this project is minimal, as per the client's instructions. We won't be linking concepts or using content-driven page views, at least initially. But wireframes are still useful. They allow us to begin envisioning the end product and the project's overall scope. For this example, we'll assume that all the wireframes have been created. Let's take a look at the wireframe for the image showcase page. This is our visual cue for figuring out what we need to code. As the client stated in the interview, he needs a page that will showcase his images. This models a list of images running down the page, each with a title and a short description to the right. Right off the bat, this is helping the process because the wireframe provides information about what will be needed for the upload form that we'll need to build so that our client can provide the images and create the accompanying text. That form will need to save the following information to the server: an image, a title for the image and the accompanying text, the text to accompany the image. The form itself will be very straightforward. There's nothing too difficult here. Look at the word in the header, though, admin. Even though there's no authentication for this site, it's worth making the header precisely descriptive to remind Mr. Christensen that this is a privileged area. Always consider carefully how best to label user interface elements. If he decides to repurpose and extend the site into a general website, for example, it'll be necessary to add site-wide authentication, login, and authorization, confirmation of required privileges. Design phase steps. To recap, while many web development teams will have their own take on the design phase, there will be some typical steps. Content mapping, sitemap, page listing. The step of mapping the content and creating the list of pages, including pages that are responses to inquiry forms, searches, or other interactive content, is important for determining the initial scope of the proposed work. Every page constitutes some kind of hourly allotment of available human resources. Every page is something that needs to be coded, tested, and shown to the client. Wireframing. Wireframing helps developers understand a page's structure and define page elements that might risk being overlooked until later in the development stage. Wireframing helps those in the marketing role understand how content should be designed. Ultimately, this step reduces the number of iterations a page will go through in the design and development stages of production. Visual design. This is best handled by those dedicated to this task. It's unusual for developers to be deeply involved with visual design on medium-size or large projects, simply because graphic design is its own discipline and is performed by established professionals. Developers do work with designers, though, in order to make everyday design tasks easy and difficult design tasks possible. Designers will want to understand how a particular interactive concept might work, for example, and project managers will want to know how long it will take to implement. Because design involves potentially complicated CSS and the production of other digital assets, it's good to start this process early in order to avoid costly and slow revisions later. Setup. Time for a walkthrough of the development process. We're going to take you step by step through a project that is set up according to typical expectations of web development. This begins with source code management. Source code management. Source code management is the practice of using dedicated software to track a software project's history, changes, contributors, and features. Source code management particularly enables the contributions of multiple developers who are able to check out and push changes to a repository. A repository, or repo, is typically a set of files and directories, along with some facility for tracking changes to those files and directories. While development teams use source code management, SCM, software as a normal part of their routine, it's a good practice even for individual developers to use SCM. Using a source code manager will help you maintain a clean code base, a code base that can always be checked out and deployed even while you're working on new features. Let's see how this is done. Note: it will be best to complete this lesson in a single, uninterrupted session. Repellit periodically refreshes development environments, erasing changes to the file system, such as those made by SCM software such as Git. If you complete this in one session, you should be fine. But if you shut down and come back the next day, the command line work you've done with Git will be lost. For the purpose of introducing you to Git, this isn't an issue. But if you were to continue with the normal development workflow, you would probably want to work with a more robust server environment, such as would be obtained with a hosting provider. Step 1. Create a GitHub account. First, we're going to create a free account at GitHub. GitHub is a site that hosts Git repositories. Git is one of the most common and most important SCM programs available right now. It was developed in 2005 by Linus Torvalds, a Finnish programmer also responsible for creating the Linux operating system. As SCM tools go, Git, pronounced with a hard G like goof but rhymes with pit, isn't the easiest software to learn, but it's not very difficult either. Once you've completed the preliminary steps, you are greeted by a welcome screen. Skip any questions asked there. Complete your setup and you'll be asked to confirm your email address. Go to your email and click on the link in the email sent by GitHub. Next, you'll be asked if you want to create your first repository, and you will be taken to the Create a New Repository page, which asks for a name, description, privacy, and any needed files. For the repository name, choose something like kiosk-site. It doesn't matter too much what you choose, but keep it on the short side. Don't use any spaces, and make sure you don't forget it. The name will be coming up again very soon. The description is optional. Keep your repository public, that's fine. You don't need a README file. READMEs are files that contain project-relevant information, everything from authorship to installation instructions to basic documentation, and so on. You don't need one for this run-through. You won't need a .gitignore file either. The .gitignore file tells Git about any files or directories that Git doesn't need to track. It's useful, and you'll typically include a .gitignore file, but it's not necessary this time. Finally, skip the license and click Create Repository. The next screen you'll see might be a little confusing. Stay here for now and don't close the window. But if you do close the window accidentally, that's fine. Just locate your repository on your dashboard and go back to it. Step 2. Create a new repel. Open a new tab in your browser and go to Repel It. Click the Plus New Repel button at the top right of your Repel It screen. Read all instructions before creating your new repel. Choose Express for the project's context. Express is a node-based application framework that makes certain parts of web development easier. We'll be using Express for this project. The next field has GitHub's Octocat mascot. You could, in theory, enter your project's GitHub URL into that field, and then when you created the repel, it would copy all of the code from GitHub into your Repel It project. However, that won't work this time. There's no code in the repo. That field only works if you're already hosting code. For now, fill in a name for the repel, kiosk site is fine, and press the Create Repel button. Your repel will be created and you'll be dropped into it. The repel should start, and after a moment, you should see Hello World in the little sample browser to the right. Step 3. Open the command line. Go ahead and click in the code window in the center of the repel. Then press F1 or Ctrl-Shift-P Windows or Command-Shift-P Mac. A pop-up window will appear in the center of the screen with a search box and a list of commands. In the text box, type the word shell. The list will narrow down until you see the Open Shell command. Select it by highlighting it and pressing Return or just clicking on it. In the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a command line. This is the key to happiness. Well, maybe that's a little extreme, but the command line is where a lot of developers live. Often, command line work is the fastest and most efficient way to get things done. Let's practice a few commands in order to get the hang of it. Go ahead and type the following command into your command line to see what version of Git Repel It has installed. After the command is typed letter for letter, press Enter or Return. From now on, when we show a command, go ahead and type it in and press Enter, unless we explicitly indicate not to do so. After you enter the command, you'll see something like this. Git version 2.1.4. The actual version might be different, but as long as you see a similar response, all is well. Git workflow. As you can see in the File Explorer section on the left of your repel, we inherited some default files to get us started. We want to add these to the repository right away. It's best practice to start your repository immediately. Don't wait until you've done some coding. The old saying in the business is, commit early and commit often. So let's commit these files. What's a commit? It's part of the basic Git workflow. One of the most common ways to work with Git is with a repository that's hosted somewhere, such as GitHub. This means the repository is shared and worked on by many people. You wouldn't want the work you are doing to mess up the repository for someone else, so the Git workflow is a way to make sure the changes you have made work and are loaded so that everyone else has access only when you are ready. Working this way means that a developer can maintain code or add new features, make sure everything is working locally, and then share the code back with the main repo. Git allows developers to clone the latest version of a repository or any version in the past. All changes at all times are saved. If anyone does add problematic code to a repo, it's easy to go back and get a version that was working perfectly. For this reason and many others, Git can be a lifesaver even if a developer is working alone. This is how a developer will typically work with such a repo. Clone the repository. They'll clone the repository onto their own computer. A clone copies the repository's files to a local repository, meaning that a repo that's located on the developer's own computer. That way, the developer can set up their own development environment and work with a copy of the files without any fear that they'll be making changes that will break anything or mess up anyone else's work. Change the files. They'll make changes to the files on their own copy of the repo. Every so often, usually after the developer has made some worthwhile changes, they'll decide that they want to add them to the repository. Stage the changed files. First, they'll stage the changed files. This means they specify which files they're going to be committing. Git allows a developer to add only the changes they've made and that they really want to save. They don't need to add all changes at once if they don't want to. Staging files isn't committing them. All the developer is doing in this step is adding the files that they want to commit together. Commit the files. After they've staged the files, they'll commit them. Committing the staged files adds the changes to the local copy of the repository. Repeat. After this, the developer will go back to changing more files and will continue with this cycle. Make a pull request. Finally, when the developer determines that it's time, the local repository's changes can be added back to the repository that's hosted on GitHub or wherever. This is usually done by making what's called a pull request, so that someone who's responsible for the hosted repository can approve the changes before they're shared with collaborators. Step 4. Identify yourself. Before we do our first commit, we need to identify ourselves. We'll be adding our name and our email address. In the following two separate commands, substitute first last with your first and last names and use your real email address. Enter each command separately. However, in this case, you won't see any response. If the command is successful, you'll simply get another prompt. Cool. Git knows who we are. Let's confirm that by retyping our commands, but without any supplied information. When you enter these commands one by one, you should see the information you just supplied. Step 5. Create your repository. Now we're ready to create our very first Git repository. Type this command, git init. Because of your command, Git went ahead and created the repository's directory, the .git directory, with all of the necessary files and directories required to track your source code. Okay, let's create our first commit. We only want to add the files we need to add. If you look at the file list in the upper left-hand corner of the repo, you'll see that you have index.js, index.html, script.js, style.css, and package.json. So let's have Git stage these files with one easy command. That's it. You've just staged the files you need to start tracking. For all of the files in the public/directory, all you need to do is specify the directory's name. Git will add everything in there automatically. Let's see what we've done. Type and enter this. Git status. You should see our 5 files, 3 of them in the public directory, have been added to the staging area. We won't worry about the untracked files. This is our starting point. The first step was to specify which files we wanted to track. Remember, too, that we can always add more files later on. Now let's commit them to our local repository. Step 6. Commit your files. The commit keyword tells Git to, yes, pretty obvious, commit. The -m option is followed by a little message in quotes. This message will tell other developers, or will remind you later on, what the changes in this commit were accomplishing. In this case, we're only adding new files and getting the ball rolling, so initial commit is a pretty typical message. You will see that Git has added your files to the repository. The response indicates 5 files changed, but this just means they've been added. It's their tracking in the repository that's changed. Nice! Now if we run Git status again, go ahead and do so, the staging area looks different. Whoa, what happened? Well, those files that have changes, in this case, brand new lines of code because they're brand new files, were added to the repository. Those changes have been added, so they're no longer being tracked. But because they're in the repo, when we do make changes to them again, Git will tell us that the file's been modified, and we'll have to add the new changes back to the staging area and then do another commit. Right about now, you might be thinking, what a phenomenal pain. Is this really necessary? Trust us when we tell you that Git will save your project, your job, and your sanity. As a rule, developers don't like to do things that are merely tedious hassles. This might seem like a lot of new material, and the advantages might not be completely obvious, but you will get to a point where you won't even want to write a single line of code without Git. Step 7. Save your repository on GitHub. Remember the GitHub repository we started? Let's put it into action. If you go to the GitHub page for your new and empty repository, you'll see something like this. Yours won't be exactly the same because your account details are a little different. What we're interested in right now are the two commands beneath the heading that reads, or push an existing repository from the command line. Whatever those two commands are for you, go ahead and type them into your command line on Repellit. No password? No problem. After you type the git push command, you'll be prompted for your GitHub login credentials. Go ahead and type in your username, which is the email address you used to sign up with GitHub. But when you type in your password, you won't see anything. That doesn't mean it's not working, it's just a security feature. So go slowly and make sure you get it right. After the command runs successfully, you'll see some lines of output. Go back to GitHub and refresh your repositories page. You now have a hosted repository. You could share your code easily, simply by giving the URL to this repo. You can click on the individual file links if you want and check out what's there. It'll be exactly the same code that you have hosted on Repellit. It's important to point out that Git itself is a distributed version control system. This means that Git doesn't need one single all-important repository. Every developer who works on a project maintains their own copy of a repository and has, along with the code, the entire history of that code in their repo. But it's often useful to host a Git repository on a site like GitHub in order to make it trivially easy for a developer to grab a project's code. Here are a few key SCM concepts to keep in mind. Git hosting. Sites like GitHub host Git repositories in order to make it easy for a project's code to be shared with other developers. Hosted repos also work as backup for projects and often have more features, like issue tracking. It will often be the case that you'll be working with a hosted repo or will want to host your own projects. Generally, this is considered best practice. GitHub also supports private repositories. Local repository. The local repository is your own copy of the project's code. It contains all of the project's tracked files and directories and the entire history of that code. You'll make all your changes to your local repo and then share changes to other repositories as necessary. If you host your code with GitHub, you'll push changes from your repo to the hosted repository when you want to back up your code or share your changes with other developers. Staging area. Your local repo's staging area is where you add changes you've made when you're ready to commit them. So far, we've seen changes staged on a per-file basis, meaning that all of the changes in a file would be added to the staging area. More advanced Git users will know how to add only partial changes to a file, if that's what they want to do. For now, just know that that's possible. Commit. When you've staged your changes, you can commit them to your repository, and they represent the latest version of your entire code base. Don't be shy about making commits. Every time you do so, you add to your code's history and you back up your work. Remember, you can always revert to a previous version of your code. Doing so won't be covered here, but it's not difficult to go back in time with Git. Okay, we're all set up for coding. We've seen how to set up a Git repository and how to connect it to GitHub. We've also seen how to stage and commit changes. Let's build that site now. Database storage. We're going to focus on three ideas needed to complete this project. Because these ideas are new, we'll just concentrate on two of the basic ideas that would be needed to complete this kind of project: storing values in a database and uploading files. We'll deal with databases here. As you go through this lesson, follow the steps in Repellit. Go to Repellit and start a new Express Repel. Name it anything you like. Connecting to a database. This is an essential web development task, and there are as many ways to connect to a database as there are databases, and there are many databases. But we'll see that really this is not very difficult. We'll be connecting to a SQL database. A SQL database uses the SQL language and tables to structure data for efficient retrieval. Complex relationships between different kinds of data can be modeled with tables too. Because of this, SQL databases are very popular. including the MySQL and PostgreSQL database, which are very frequently specified. We'll be connecting to a simple but powerful SQL database called SQLite. In order to accomplish this, we'll use the SQLite middleware package. Middleware is software that enables interactions that happen between layers of a software system. That's a pretty generic definition, but in a web context, middleware is used for many different things: handling errors, dealing with session data, logging functions, and so on. All the stuff that's absolutely necessary and not immediately exciting. In Express, all middleware has access to the request object, usually abbreviated as REC, and the response object, RES. Some middleware is built into Express, but there are middleware libraries that you can add to your application to make certain tasks easier. SQLite is one of those libraries. Let's take a look at a simple example. In an Express application, the index.js file is the entry point. That's the file that contains the application's starting logic and setup. Express apps can be quite complex and involved, but you'll see how straightforward this task is. We have three files we need to code in order to get going. Let's start with the package.json file. The package.json file contains information about all of the application's needed libraries, or dependencies. The file is in the form of JSON data. JSON stands for JavaScript Object Notation, which is a very convenient way to store information. JSON is essentially just data stored in a JavaScript object so that JavaScript can very easily load and make use of it. JSON is a very common data format, and you'll encounter it often. There is some additional configuration information in this file, too, but we're mainly interested in the dependencies specification. Here we have three required libraries: the Express Application Library, the Body Parser Library, and the SQLite Middleware Database Library. We need to make sure we add SQLite to this dependency list so that our application will load and use it. On Repellit, all we will need to do is to modify this file so that the SQLite library is listed as a dependency, and Repellit will install it automatically. You might be wondering about the confusing string that follows the dependency names. In SQLite's case, the string is in quotes, 3.0.3. This is just a shorthand way of telling Node — remember, Express is a Node framework — that version 3.0.3 of the SQLite library should be used. Our HTML file will be very simple, and we'll merely supply a link to another page so we can see the data we add being retrieved from the database. Make sure your index.html file matches this one. You're pretty familiar with this by now. Now let's take a look at the core code. Make sure your index.js file match. Let's walk through these lines and see what they do. The first three lines of code make the libraries accessible to our application by assigning instances of the libraries to variables. Those variables now can be used to access various functions in the libraries. The fourth line of code uses the Express variable we just assigned to create an instance of an Express application. Ultimately, this variable is what's going to be used to start our application server, which is exactly what the last line of code in our example accomplishes. We can see that the last line of code takes two arguments: a port number and a callback function. If you were running this code on a local server, you'd access your running application by typing the following URL: http://localhost:3000. The 3000 is a port number. It's an arbitrary number between 1024 and 49151. That an application can use to make itself distinct while providing a service over a busy network. You can think of it as a kind of numeric tag. The callback function is called after the application starts listening or running as a server that waits for connections. In this case, our function simply logs to the console, indicating that we're up and running. Let's head back up to where we left off. Right after we create our Express application, we create the DB variable, which creates and connects to our database. It's that simple. Now we can store values and retrieve them later on. In our example, the database is created in the computer's memory, but we could just as easily create it as a file on disk if we wanted. All we need to do is supply a file name. Next down the list is the dbserialize function and all that it contains. First of all, dbserialize is needed, especially at the beginning, in order to make sure that all database functions run one at a time. JavaScript runs asynchronously, meaning that, and this will seem somewhat strange at first, not all lines of JavaScript code run one at a time, or one right after the next, in order. This is something of an advanced topic, so we won't go into detail right now, but it's worth pointing out that while asynchronous code execution has some very large advantages, it also creates some challenges. Sometimes we need to tell JavaScript to wait for a second, or as with the case of SQLite, we need to specify that certain statements will run in a specific order. That's what the dbserialize function accomplishes. Where SQLite is concerned, statements within that function will be executed one at a time and in order. Before we take a look at what happens in dbserialize, it's worth pointing out that you're about to see a few SQL statements. SQL stands for Structured Query Language, and it's an old and very familiar way to query databases for information. SQL statements can nearly be read out loud as English sentences, which makes the syntax relatively easier to learn, though SQL statements can become quite complicated. The SQL statements presented here should be fairly straightforward, but it would be a good exercise to do a search for a SQL tutorial or introduction online. There are many great resources. Within dbserialize, a few things happen. Create the table. We run a dbrun statement that immediately executes the SQL statement in quotes. This statement creates a table called images containing two fields, name and desk. Both of these fields will store text values. Prepare the statement. Then we prepare a new insert statement and assign the result of a dbprepare to the statement variable. The dbprepare function allows a statement to be run multiple times and with different values. Each time the statement is run, the question marks will be replaced with supplied values. Very useful. Run and finalize. The next few lines run the insert statement with supplied values, and then we delete the statement with a call to finalize. The finalize step is necessary in order to free up computing resources like memory. Now, skip down to the root for images, the code before the app listen call at the end. This is the code that selects all the values that we've added to the database and sends them back as a JSON array of objects. This is called when you click the Go to Images List link on the DB Connection page. Feel free to copy this code into a Repellit Express Repel and try it out. Be sure to restart your Repel before you click the link. You want to make sure all the new code is loaded by the server. Connecting to a SQLite database is a very common web development task, and the process is not unlike connecting to other databases. It's useful to take note of the databases that come with a web browser, too. Cookies are a kind of storage used by developers to store small key-value pairs of data, such as session IDs or shopping cart information. This is data mainly meant for use on servers. Session tracking is a common task associated with cookies. They're associated with a site's domain and often with a specific page, though they can be set in order to be retrieved from any page on the site. They're very easy to use, but they do expire. The default expiration is when the user closes their browser or clears their cookies in the browser settings. There's no need to enter this, just follow along. Alternatively, you can specify a different expiration by specifying a date in UTC GMT format. You'll need to look this up. Getting all the cookies for a domain is as simple as referencing a single property. The allCookies variable will contain a string representing all the cookies associated with the domain. If there is more than one cookie available, the cookies will be separated by a semicolon. Some string manipulation might be necessary to get at the values, but there are libraries that make this easier. Local storage is a standard feature of modern web browsers. Local storage allows JavaScript apps to save data without an expiration date. This storage is permanent, or until the user purposely deletes it. Local storage is mainly for reading data on the client side, and is most often used by web applications that need fast data storage and access for a specific purpose. This can be very handy. Local storage data is accessed through JavaScript. If the data to be stored will be read and needed on the client side, local storage is the way to go. Saving data is easy. And retrieving data is easy too. Objects can be stored with JSON by using the stringify method. Finally, session storage is similar to local storage, but expires when the user closes the browser. Whew, that's a lot of database and data storage knowledge. Don't worry, there's a lot more. But this has been a good start. Let's take a quick look at file uploads in the next lesson. Uploads and testing plans. Form-based file uploads. Uploading files is pretty similar to database connectivity, at least in the sense that the basic functionality doesn't require a lot of setup, and a little middleware comes in handy. Setting up file uploads in Express should feel a little familiar. Our directory structure is similar, but with a place to save our file uploads. Create an Express repel on Repellit, and then add an uploads directory with an images directory within it. You can delete the script.js and style.css files that are generated by default. This is what the result should look like. Once again, you'll modify the package.json file. We're going to be using the Multer middleware package. Note the dependency list. This time, the HTML file includes a simple form, but there are a couple of new parts. Make your index.html file match this. The first new part is the enctype attribute of the form tag. The multi-part form data value is required for file uploads. The second new part is the file input type. This will give us a browser-defined file chooser. In this case, it's named showcase image. Finally, let's take a look at the upload logic in index.js. Here's the entire content for your index.js file. Take a few minutes to examine the code line by line. The necessary packages are instantiated, including the Multer package. Next, we define a storage variable that configures some storage options. This is required by the Multer package itself. Then we set up an upload object that will be used in the form's postroute. In the postroute, the block of code right before the call to the listen method, we upload the file, checking to make sure that one was specified, and then, if so, using the send method of the res object to complete the upload. The upload object itself will handle the rest, saving the file into the uploads images directory specified in the storage options. Once again, try it out by copying the code into the repel you've created for this lesson and giving it a shot. Repellit doesn't allow file uploads in this way, but you will see a response with the file's information. If this code were running on a local server, the file would upload just fine though. The test plan. Along the way, we're going to need to think about testing what we're building. In fact, it's considered current best practice to start testing immediately, before you've built anything. Test-driven development, TDD, is a discipline that stresses the idea of writing tests first, before you've written any functional code, so that you're always thinking carefully about what success and failure means. We won't be covering TDD here, but we do need to start thinking about testing. A test plan defines strategies for testing web pages in order to ensure that code works as specified. A test plan also helps with determining overall project scope by asking what exactly will be involved with making sure the site works well. Depending upon what you're trying to accomplish, a test plan will include different categories of tests and different testing strategies. But let's start by thinking about testing a single web page with a three-step plan. Step 1. Analyze the problem the page is supposed to solve. We begin by asking what exactly the page is supposed to accomplish. The page shouldn't exist unless it's fulfilling some role or service, so we once again think of the user. Who is this person? Why is the user here? What constitutes a successful conversion? What will lead the user to act in some way that defines success? The answers to these questions should be written down in the most precise terms achievable. Step 2. Determine the test strategy. What is the best way to test in order to determine that the user will obtain the results that best suit their needs? How can we produce evidence of an interaction that demonstrates success or failure? In the first step, we analyzed the page and the page's users. In this step, we're analyzing the best way to know that the user has gotten what they need. Step 3. Document the test and the evidence. Testing is an ongoing concern. As soon as possible, it's best to begin the testing process and documenting the results in order to refine the process and the tests themselves. To that end, set up a schedule that fits in with the process and makes testing, test documentation, and test review regular events in the project's development. This is a pretty high-level view of testing. Truthfully, developers test regularly, and from a technical standpoint alone, different tests serve different purposes. Unit testing. Unit tests evaluate individual components in a software system. Unit tests often test components that the end user never directly sees. Integration testing. This kind of testing may evaluate multiple components and interactive elements of the site. Units of functionality are tested for how they work together. The list goes on. The main thing to remember here is that you should think about how your site will be tested and write down how that will work. The three-step process above is a good place to begin. As your skills grow and you interact with other developers, more sophisticated planning and testing techniques will become a part of your development practice. Knowledge check. Test your knowledge of new information by answering these questions and then review the feedback. Question 1. What should be done before the implementation phase of the software development lifecycle and why? Option 1. Maintenance to prevent bugs. Incorrect. Maintenance is important, but it happens after the implementation phase. Option 2. Maintenance for search engine optimization. Incorrect. Maintenance is important, but it happens after the implementation phase. Option 3. Creating a sitemap to identify a site's users. Incorrect. Creating a sitemap is important, but it doesn't identify a site's users. Option 4. Creating a sitemap to identify each task in the project. Correct. Creating a sitemap makes it easier to create a list of the tasks needed to complete the development of the site itself. Question 2. Mai is a new intern at a web development company. She has been asked to conduct a preliminary competitive analysis for a new project. Which of these should she do and why? Option 1. Study competitors' websites to get ideas for this project. Correct. A competitive analysis involves studying the websites of other websites that compete with the one that you are developing. Option 2. Study competitors' websites to be sure that their project is not too similar. Incorrect. A competitive analysis does involve studying other websites, but the goal is not to avoid being similar to them. Of course, plagiarism and copyright violations are not acceptable, but it's fine to get ideas from what is or is not working well on similar websites. Option 3. Establish internal teams that will compete to meet their deadlines first. Incorrect. This isn't a correct description of what a competitive analysis involves. A competitive analysis involves examining the websites of other competing companies. Option 4. Establish internal teams that will develop the same website to see which one does the best job. This isn't a correct description of what a competitive analysis involves. A competitive analysis involves examining the websites of other competing companies. Question 3. Some people use GitHub for projects that do not involve code. Which of these would be the most appropriate non-coding project to host on GitHub? Option 1. A draft of a list of local restaurants that you'd like others to modify, stored in a public repository. Correct. This is a project that could work well on GitHub. Option 2. Storing medical records in a public repository. Incorrect. When a GitHub repository is public, that means anyone can see its contents, so it would be inappropriate for medical records. Option 3. A research paper for a science competition so that your team of 4 students can access it, stored in a public repository. Incorrect. Working collaboratively with GitHub could be a good idea, but if it is for a competition, a private repository would be more appropriate. Option 4. Documents that a city government wants to make accessible to taxpayers stored in a private repository. If the documents should be widely accessible, a public repository is more appropriate. Conclusion. And here we are. We've come a long way covering a lot of ground. You now have enough knowledge to tackle basic development tasks in a professional manner. You also have a pretty strong overview of the web development field from a professional developer's point of view. from clients to user-centered design to workflow to some of the nuts and bolts of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, you have a broad foundation in the field. It might be possible now to say there's a lot more to learn. To be perfectly honest, though, that's always the case in software. New technologies, approaches, and workflows are emerging right now as you read this. Something's always the flavor of the month, or year, or decade, and developers are continuously learning. To be honest, learning is a big part of the job. By getting this far, you've shown you've got the chops from a learning perspective. Nice work. Keep it up.